from the Carter Subaru Studios. This is the G and Ursula Show with G Scott and Ursula Voitin.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Tuesday to all of you. G is off again today. Mike Lewis is in once again. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Ursula.
Gosh, I got into the car around 7 o'clock this morning, and you know what? It felt like, even though it was cold as heck.
Felt like spring.
I had the exact
same feeling.
It was like, it's so light outside.
It was nice seeing it, like, and it was kind of a nice sunrise. I mean,
yes,
as early as I got up today.
Gorgeous.
It was beautiful, and I felt like, you know, and I know that this isn't true. Every time I get that little bit of hope when I buy a lottery ticket, I know that this is not true. But it felt like we turned a corner.
Yes.
I don't even want to say it because now immediately this is going to be like a snowstorm coming in by tomorrow. But it felt good. No. I completely agree with you.
Yes.
Enjoy it while you can, because
exactly.
Daylight saving time, it's going to be dark again when we get up.
But
in
then,
a week.
You know, even that is indicative of how close we are to warmer weather.
Exactly.
So, good point.
Okay, so how would you feel about your neighbors building a duplex or even up to four small cottages on their property? That could very well become reality under a bill that is being considered in Olympia right now. We're going to dig into that after Heather's newscast coming up at 9:30. As always, we invite you to engage with us on our state roofing text line, 888-973-5476, 888-973-CHIRO. Right now, it's time for our top stories brought to you by Wayscar Ford Isuzu in Auburn. And teachers in our state are now leaving the classroom at historically high rates. That's according to a new study released today. Between 2021 and 2022, there was a 1.6% increase in the number of teachers who quit their jobs in Washington. That means districts would have had to hire more than 1,000 teachers for the current school year just to make up for that loss. Jamila Bomani is a fourth grade teacher in the Seattle School District, and she tells Cairo 7 TV she's not surprised about this educator exodus.
What we are dealing with in the classroom is difficult, and it's difficult on multiple levels. There's just a lot going on with expectations from the district and from families and what you want for students and what they also need socially and emotionally.
So, Mike, this study also found that the biggest increase in teacher turnover was in high poverty schools, and the most likely teachers to leave were the ones who were just starting or who were in the middle of their careers. And again, Bomani says that's not a surprise either.
Could I buy a house and establish myself in Seattle as a Seattle public school teacher? Mostly no. We've had teachers leave mid-year, first or second year, and it was just too much. And it was they said, you know what? I can be doing something else that is less stressful.
So what do you do?
I don't know what you do. I don't think that actually in Seattle proper, I think the salaries are not bad. They're not probably maybe what they should be, but they're not terrible. They're actually decent salaries in Seattle city schools. However,
$67,000 starting.
Right,
a year.
Starting, but it goes up fairly rapidly after that. The issue, I think, that people need to focus on here, salaries is always going to be something. Teachers are going to be underpaid for the rest of our lives. That's the fact of the matter. And it's a shame that they are, because they shouldn't be. And I completely
and
would love
people,
to see teachers getting a lot more money than they do.
I was going to say, there are listeners right now who are just about to text us and say they are not underpaid. They don't work during the summer, blah, 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 blah,
blah, blah. Right. But you and I know, right? So, but I would also say that the one thing that we don't talk a whole lot about is the working conditions. And I think working conditions are a massive driver, particularly when, and if you look at this thing, it's mostly the teachers who are in that 1 to 10 year category who are leaving at higher rates. In this study, these are the folks who came in with this idea about teaching and found out that the reality and the idea that there is a unbridgeable cavern between those two places, and that it involves class size, which is difficult. It involves, and I'm sorry, folks, it involves probably dealing with parents to some degree, which can be a nightmare. It can involve dealing with your school superintendent or principal, which also can be a nightmare, because teachers are struggling right now with changes in curriculum that don't make a whole lot of sense, that they're not well trained to deal with. In addition to incredible administrative responsibilities, in addition to, in some cases, practically raising kids for parents. I mean, this is never been an easy job, but I think in particular now, and then when you add that to a 35 person class size, you can see why people would be overwhelmed by the job and figure that maybe this is not something that I want to do. But I don't know. Here's the thing that, and also when there's a big economy, and some of this data goes back a couple of years, right? Mm-hmm. When there's a boom economy, you historically will see drops in teacher because people can make a lot more money in other jobs. So some of this is just explained by somebody saying, hey, wait a minute, I could jump over to this tech company and be a communications specialist and go up $30,000 a year in salary. And some of that is that, and that's nothing that you can always sufficiently addressed. But the other things regarding teacher working conditions, you can.
Well, and speaking of working conditions, so I have a lot of family members who are teachers, and I have friends who are teachers. And without exception, they told me in the last couple of years during the pandemic, those were the hardest years that
Absolutely.
They have ever had to deal with, not just because of remote teaching, but what also happened to the kids and how, I mean, for lack of a better word, unruly many of the kids became.
Right.
You know, the anxiety and depression and all the different things that also were rolled into what happened during the pandemic, where kids, even at a very young age, were becoming physically aggressive.
Right.
And I think teachers, like police officers, in many ways, I think society expects so much of them.
I completely agree.
Right? Like, it's a catch-all, it's a job that we expect you to do everything.
Right. And disproportionately, you know, that we all remember the good teachers that we had and how valuable they were for shaping, you know, a particular point in all of our lives. And so I don't think that there's any doubt. I've never talked to anyone who couldn't bring up at least one teacher that was terrific. But I would also say that stress, that post-pandemic stress, may be why we're seeing this. And perhaps once we roll back into some sort of normalcy after this, maybe that will level off. I don't know. But I don't know that it's specific to that, because teachers were complaining about a lot of the working condition things prior to the pandemic.
That's true.
And it's very important to remember that this is not solely a pandemic problem. But I do think that you have to account for that in the mix.
Absolutely. Okay, you know who's really underpaid? The people who work at homeless shelters, food banks, crisis hotlines, and child care and elder care centers. There's a new study from the University of Washington that says the median annual income for human services workers was about $34,000 in 2019, and that was compared to a median of about $55,000 a year for full-time workers in non-care industries. This report outlined in Crosscut, and they say this wage gap also has gender and racial equity implications. So think about who is most likely to work these types of jobs.
Women.
Exactly. Bingo. Women and people of color.
Right.
And many immigrant populations, right? And so women account for nearly 80% of all human service workers in King County, and workers of color are also overrepresented in these low-paid positions.
I mean, so if you're getting the theme so far of the show, it's it's criminally underpaid jobs, because this is even, like, for all we've said about teachers, at 33 to 37%, less than what they ought to be making, given what private companies will pay these same folks. Remember, so cities and counties frequently, for a lot of these services, contract to groups, and these groups then pay people. The question I have for you then is, should cities and municipalities require a minimum pay?
Yes.
You know, that's the thing, because what happens is they give a contract and they require sort of a minimum staffing level, but then they just sort of are their hands off on a lot of other things other than sort of the health code requirements on how clean a place needs to be or a variety of issues like that. But they don't actually require minimum salaries in many cases. Now, maybe there are cities out there that do, but in many cases, I know for a fact that they don't.
Okay,
and maybe that's what needs to happen.
I think that would be at a minimum. The authors of this study were talking about just right away, you need to increase their wages by 7% across the board. I mean, that would just be keeping up with the rate of inflation.
Barely. Having kept up with the rate of inflation over the last 10 years.
Exactly. And then by 2030, they recommend at least a 40% raise from current salary level system, which would make much. But how many times in a week do we talk about our homelessness crisis, our mental health crisis, our drug crisis, and how there just aren't enough services available? Well, one way to make services available is maybe pay the people
Absolutely.
Who are going to be providing those services.
And then on top of that, allow like people to move through the system, licensing system faster. There's a lot of ancillary things that come along with that.
This is absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy to me. Because we've talked ad nauseum about staffing issues for policing in the state, which is a critical issue. And we always hear about, hey, what are you going to do if you call the police and there's no one there to pick up the phone?
That's right.
Well, if we dispatch police to all these emergencies for mental health, for homelessness, for drug use, etc., who are they supposed to call? They call for services. We expect, quote, services to fix all of the problems that we see on our streets and in our societies. And we have direct level people working with the homeless who make an average of $19.70. Managers make $24.92 on average. And the mayor had actually proposed in September cutting the pay increases of human services workers from 7.6%, which is legally mandated, to 4%. This
surprising.
Is a hair on fire crisis right now, but nobody's standing up for these workers because they generally don't have unions. They don't have public voices. There are no politicians that are stumping for these folks. And so the only time you're going to hear about this is a little article in Crosscut. Maybe the Seattle Times will have a protest on the front page one day a year and a couple mentions on the radio. But beyond that, let's just hope that all the homeless get services.
Yeah, exactly. Like on a hope and a prayer.
Who's doing the work?
Yeah, exactly. So that is something to think about as we discuss this crisis that seems to be getting worse every single year. A King County Metro bus driver says all the fentanyl smoke that he has to deal with on the job is just making him really sick.
It still is a great job besides the fentanyl smoking on the bus. You have people on the smoking right beside passengers, right beside mothers with little children.
Stevon Williams tells Como 4 News he didn't sign up for this kind of health hazard. He is now on leave while he gets medical testing for fentanyl smoke exposure.
This isn't secondhand smoke. This is smoke being lit on aluminum foil that's coming directly into the air that us bus drivers are breathing. You know, and it makes me really, really sick.
Now, it's interesting that a social worker for Seattle and King County Public Health had testified last year that secondhand fentanyl exposure is not a thing.
We're not seeing folks developing secondhand exposure from touching, from, you know, this is just not happening.
And I should also point out that Metro says using drugs on board buses is strictly prohibited, Mike. The agency is working to double its staff of security guards to respond to all these safety issues and drug use on buses and transit stations.
I think what struck me about the quote from the bus driver is that it must be a spectacularly good job to say it's a good job other than the fentanyl smoke. Because I was like, well, that's an interesting qualifier. It's a dynamite job, other than the gunshots. But in all seriousness, I mean, I actually don't necessarily disbelieve the health department. They generally are pretty accurate when they make these assessments. Now, I don't know if they've been testing individual bus drivers, and I don't know if they've gone maybe far enough down this road. But let's just say, for example, that it's true. We do know that there's a lot like touching it, whatnot, is not a way to actually ingest it. But the fact that people are smoking fentanyl on the buses is actually still a problem. And that is not, whether or not it's making somebody sick is not, should not be our baseline about handling it. Or we should handle it because it's a problem, from sheltering in the buses to smoking in the buses to a variety of other things that are happening. The bus drivers are out there. And if you've been on buses in Seattle or any other town, particularly on some routes, the bus drivers are alone. There is no one there that is going to help them anytime soon. And I can't imagine if you're a bus driver and it's night and you've got one person in the back smoking fentanyl, that you're feeling particularly good about this being a great job.
No. Well, and then on top of that, like who is going to want to be on that bus or that light rail train when whether or not that smoke does actually make you sick? I don't know, but I would not feel like this is a particularly safe place to be. And so them, the Metro saying we've doubled our security. So I don't know what double means, but right. maybe it needs to be tripled.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
because every single day we hear
one to two
story.
Is doubling. Yeah. Right. So exactly. maybe we should know those numbers exactly. before we get impressed by it.
As long as we're talking about hair on fire responses, that should be one of them, too, because,
Absolutely.
We've spent way too much on public transit to being okay with that. I mean,
right. No, I completely agree. And again, we're talking about, so who do they then call? Let's go back to our previous story and find out if there's anyone there to pick up the phone, right?
Yes.
All of this stuff is very interrelated.
Exactly. Okay, so he won the NFL's Comeback Player of the Year award, and now Geno Smith is coming back to the Seattle Seahawks. He was reportedly offered a 3-year deal that could earn him up to $105 million, including up to $52 million in the first calendar year. NFL insider Adam Schefter says it's no surprise that the two sides worked out this deal.
I think the league-wide assumption all along was that Geno Smith and the Seahawks were a marriage made for each other. It worked out great this past year when he won the Comeback Player of the Year, and most people expected that relationship to continue into this next year, which it now will with this 3-year contract extension.
How are you feeling about this?
I think it was a good move. I mean, it really is. So one of the things I wasn't able, and are we going to be talking to Mike Salk later on today?
Potentially.
One of the things that I didn't see in the story that I was reading earlier was how much of that. Remember, it's an NFL contract, so how much of that money is guaranteed money? They keep saying up to. Well, up to means with a variety of incentives, so it actually isn't really the number. And plus, right. NFL contracts being non-guaranteed means they can cut you, and you don't get that entire contract. You only are guaranteed the guaranteed money portion. That said, he did a nice job last year. It proved that what they're doing with the team makes some sense, and it still gives them a little bit of freedom with draft picks to build up the team in other areas. I think it was a smart move, and I like the guy.
I do like the guy too, and he was the Comeback Player of the Year. I am a little bit concerned though, because that is a large chunk of change. And
smaller than the Russell Wilson chunk of change.
Yeah, that's true. Half of the season wasn't that great for Geno. But was that Geno, or was that the fact that our defense needs much more help?
I think the season for him, what he did was good. I think that it was actually quite good and way better than anyone expected.
Yeah, for sure.
So we'll see next year with a full year as a starter what the team is actually able to do. And we'll find out how much this thing is really worth.
Okay, text us 888-973-5476, 888-973-CHIRO. How are you feeling about Geno coming back and getting that big contract? Still ahead, the days of single-family housing neighborhoods could soon be coming to an end. A bill in Olympia would allow for 2 units of housing on nearly every single city property in our state. We're going to dig into that next here on the G. and Ursula Show. Thank you so much for joining us on the G and Ursula Show. G is off again today. Mike Lewis is in. One of the topics we bring up quite often is the lack of affordable housing. And how do you create more? There was just a recent estimate that said we need 1 million new homes in Washington in the next 20 years just to meet population growth. And so right now in Olympia, there is a bill that would require that all small and medium-sized cities in the whole state, they would have to allow 2 to 4 times the number of homes on residential properties. So this could happen within the next 3 months if the Senate passes a bipartisan bill that just cleared the House. So Representative Jessica Bateman testified that for first-time homeowners, there are only 3 counties in the entire state that are affordable, and all of them are on the east side.
Young people are being priced out of the opportunity for a future that they deserve. They are being priced out of putting down roots. They are being priced out of building equity. They are being priced out of starting a family.
So let me give you a couple of specifics, Mike, because this is what the bill would require. Cities between 25 to 75,000 people would have to allow at least 2 units per residential lot. So These would include backyard cottages, duplexes, or townhomes. And then at least 4 units per lot if you are within a half mile of walking distance from a major transit stop or a community amenity. So that would mean you could also have 4-plexes. And cities with a population of at least 75,000 would have to allow at least 4 units per lot, at least 6 units per lot within a half mile of walking distance of a major transit stop, and at least 6 units per lot if 2 of those units are affordable housing.
So what you're going to have here, a couple of things. One, and by major transit, they don't mean a bus stop in front of your house. They actually mean like a hub system. So it has
like
to be
light rail station.
Or a big bus, yes. You know, transit station, something like that. It can't just be, you know, a bus stop in front of your house. But what I think is going to happen is there's going to be a land grab by investment companies if you own a house in Seattle, you have received the unsolicited letter for your house. How many have you received? I was getting one a week.
Yes.
And at some point, you know, and they were doing it during the pandemic. At some point you think that's bad now. That's going to ratchet up. Now, I'm fortunate enough to have actually been able to, like at the height of the mortgage crisis, I sort of, the bottom rung jumped or dropped just low enough so I could grab it, literally, because it was like that house was unaffordable to me 7 months after I was able just to squeak in and get it. So I consider myself extremely lucky that I actually have a house in Seattle. However, what is going to happen is this is going to rapidly ramp up developer purchasing of these homes and then these things being developed. You are not going to see your neighborhoods staying the same, certainly single family neighborhoods. So I think most people need to get comfortable with the idea that it's going to change pretty rapidly. I think what's also going to change, I mean, remember, go back 150 years, Manhattan was farms. I mean, you know, this is like these big cities evolve and change, and there's no real way to stop it. The way it's been stopped artificially is zoning. And so zoning is going to be, it's essentially a city's DNA. It is going to determine how cities look. So from Seattle to Tacoma, you know, to Vancouver.
So already in the city of Seattle, I believe it was in 2019, Mayor Durkan, there were some changes made that allowed for
the ADUs.
ADUs.
Right.
And so just the other day, my husband and I were driving around our old neighborhood in Ballard, and we were looking at our house, and we went through the alley because I wanted to see, like, well, what has changed?
Right.
You're snooping. Well, our neighbor, so our former neighbor,
right,
turned their garage into an ADU.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't change things that dramatically. Now, I don't live there anymore, you know, and I know that there wasn't a parking requirement. So I can imagine if suddenly you have a bunch of additional properties on every single
right
lot.
Well, so I can actually speak to that because that actually has happened in my neighborhood. My neighborhood, I live in the Inner Bay side of Magnolia. Mostly the houses down there, at least certainly are like 800, 750, 800 square, like tiny houses. But the lots are not big. I mean, I think the average lot size in Washington State is something like 10,000 feet, which puts it right about mid-pack. Nevada being, weirdly enough, the smallest lots. Vermont being the biggest. There's like the average lot size in Vermont is something like 78,000 square feet. It's something ridiculous. But so on this, the city changed the zoning right at the street that I am on. And half, in the last 10 years, and I've been there 10 years, maybe half of the houses have disappeared and turned into expensive $700,000 townhomes, like three unit townhome structures all down the alley. Now, has it affected me in a bad way? Well, there is a irritation factor. One, there's a lot more traffic because this is I live off Dravis. This is a steep street.
Okay, I know.
And it is, so you use the alley a lot. Most of the time your driveway is in the alley. It's not on the front of the house. And so there's a lot more traffic in the alley. Weirdly enough, the main irritation is that a lot of the new people in the neighborhood are not terribly friendly. Like, I don't know anyone in the neighborhood. When it was renters, I kind of knew everyone. The wealthier people who've moved in are just not very friendly.
So
I don't know what it is.
It's wealthier people that moved in?
Well, I'm guessing it would have to be because these are $800,000 and $900,000 condos
selling. See, and that's the part where I ask, how does this help?
So the idea being supply and demand, right? That we have in Seattle, as we've increased density, the one thing we have not increased is affordability in any respect whatsoever. And so we have been building at a rate that is not as fast as incomes were increasing. Now, weirdly enough, enough with this mild to major recession sort of looming on the horizon and with building still ramping up, you're trying to build your way out of the problem. But we have not been keeping up. This is a radical move to make sure that we can build out in front of a housing demand that we've never caught up to. We've never caught up to it.
So I don't think it's going to be as hyperbolic a change as you make it out to be, Mike. I know Minneapolis did this in 2018. They upzoned the whole city, one of the most famous upzones in the country recently. That went into place in January of 2020. And within about a year and a half, they'd had maybe like 80 new duplexes built and applied for, like 20 or so triplexes. Now,
You do understand, though, the radical difference between the amount, the fire hose of money pointed at Seattle as opposed. I mean, there's not.
Yeah, and
there's
we're
not
also
even,
talking about smaller cities in Washington. I'm not just talking
even
about Seattle.
A realistic comparison between smaller cities in Washington and Minneapolis. If you look at growth rates, you will not find Minneapolis anywhere near Vancouver, Washington.
So what you're saying then is that this is good news?
No,
that we are going to see a lot more building.
I'm not saying good news or bad news, and I'm not saying anything. What was your term? Hyperbolic. What I'm saying is that it's going. I've watched a change.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm not angry about that change. I'm saying it's a change. And it is going to be a change in a place that you have a tremendous amount of growth pressure, which is different here than Minneapolis for the last 60 years. It's different. Minneapolis is not an accurate comparison. Minneapolis also, you know what Minneapolis doesn't have? Any other growth restrictions from environmental review. There is a very different city. You can go ahead and say that. Use Minneapolis and 80 units. Do you think if Seattle had done the same thing, it'd only be 80 units? We saw more than 80 units with restrictions on last year. We saw like, what was it? 4,000 units with restrictions. So they're not. That's not a realistic comparison, Andrew. It's not even close.
Here's what it will do, though. It's going to make it affordable for people who can't get into a home.
I completely agree with that.
If you can't come up with $800,000 to get into an actual home, do you think you could afford a loan for $300,000 to build a cottage?
Yeah.
Or go in on a duplex with a friend?
I completely agree.
So for that population, it's great news. Now, I heard from someone over the weekend who said, my father is freaking out right now and is writing to the state legislature because, you know, we're talking about, let's say, a property in Normandy Park or a property in Des Moines when you're, looking at a 15 or 20,000 square foot piece of property,
right,
where suddenly four, entire units could be plopped in there. Their feeling is, hey, this is going to really change the neighborhood.
It's going to change the neighborhood. Yes, they're absolutely correct. It's going to change the neighborhood. I'm not saying it's changing it for the worse, but it's going to change the neighborhood.
People won't feel like it's a good thing. But I am one of those that has swung over to, you know what? We keep talking about this problem every single day, and if we do nothing,
we need to do something about it.
If we do nothing, nothing's going to change.
Absolutely.
Okay, still ahead, we're going to lighten things up because Heather is going to join us, and we're going to be talking about frogs. Okay, you'll want to stick around because you know it's going to be a great piece. Heather did it. This is the GNR Slow Show. It's 9:50 and you're listening to the G and Ursula Show. It is time to take a walk, or let's maybe call it a hop on the wild side. That's cute. It is late winter and it is prime breeding season for a group of frogs in Portland, but the little four-legged creatures have a big problem.
A group of northern red-legged frogs lives in northwest Portland's Forest Park, but they breed in the Harborton wetland between the two sides. Highway 30, two local roads, and two sets of railroad tracks. That can lead to a lot of squished froggies. Fortunately, the frogs can fit neatly into the palm of one's hand. And as this nice herpetologist on the Oregon Wildlife Foundation website explains,
the Harborton Project volunteers help the frogs by picking them up and moving them safely over these obstacles to their breeding wetland.
The Harborton Frog Shuttle now has 40 dedicated volunteers participating in a real-life game of Frogger. The human shuttle will bring the frogs back to Forest Park when breeding season is over. Now, the long-term plan is to create new local pond habitat for the frogs. But until then, the human shuttle continues. Frog mortality is down, and there is evidence of successful mating.
Froggy went a-courtin' and he did ride,
Heather Bosch, Hybro News Radio.
And we're going to have Heather hop on here for just a second.
I'll just hop on in.
Okay, oh, Heather, what caught your attention here on this story?
What do you not love about this story? I mean, you've got frogs, and they, you know, there's video on the foundation's website of people picking up these little frogs and carrying them to safety. And I feel for the frogs, man. They're just living their life, and then somebody puts railroad tracks right down the middle of your breeding ground. You know, it's got to be tough to be a frog.
Well, it's also sort of part of what we don't sometimes recognize when we put in a road or we put in a railway or things like that, that we're actually cutting off migration patterns for that certain species need. I mean, we know now, you know, I know that Chris Sullivan has talked about these. Everyone else at Cairo probably has too, but the what they refer to as the critter crossings on I-90, and they've been pretty successful.
They've
actually allowed the sort of regular, pinched but regular migration that these animals have enjoyed for, you know, thousands of years.
Yeah, I think moose are showing up in places that they hadn't been before.
And who doesn't want that?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in fact, so that was something that was just reported on, right? I mean, so it was recently spotted near Rainier National Park. The first time one has been seen in Southwest Washington. And how did they get there?
Through the I-90 Wildlife Corridor passages. Yeah. I think this is amazing. And by the way, if you think this is a tiny story about frogs, I will remind you that Washington is on the hook for about $3.7 billion worth of culvert replacements expressly to allow salmon to cross the road.
Absolutely.
Because we've had such a drastic impact on the environment of salmon.
Yeah.
And so just wait until a court decision comes down about, say, frogs or, you know, what are they, the spotted darters or any of the other small animals that are having trouble migrating. And we could see potentially large financial impacts. So thank you to the volunteers for taking this on.
Absolutely. Well, they're a big part of the ecosystem too. We can't forget that.
Yes, you know? Exactly. Well, the other thing is, I just remember when there were so many people who were very critical of this idea of, oh my gosh, this looks like a bridge to nowhere. And why are we spending that much money? Because we're going to have one, you know, rare animal crossing. Well, actually, the Department of Transportation estimates that at least 20,000 wildlife, anywhere from bobcats to snowshoe hares and now moose, have used the crossings.
Well, and if you look, there's cameras set up so you can actually enjoy watching them. They literally, there's YouTube channels devoted to watching the critters crossing here. Now, obviously, a lot of that, you're not going to see anything, but there's going to be periods of time where you will. And I think, and again, I think these things are low-level investments that have a massive impact on the natural environment.
I think we need a little froggy passing, a little froggy arc where they could just go over the top of the streets and not have to rely on the humans. Hop on the way.
Okay, further. We'll work on that one. Thank you, Heather. Appreciate it. Okay, still ahead, what's new at 10? We're going to have our reporter, Matt Markovich, join us because he always knows how to get us our blood boiling when it comes to things that are being talked about in Olympia. So we'll have that coming up next on the G and Ursula Show.